Two questions. Last time you were here, you spoke about how when you go overseas, you are given access to the mass media. But here, that doesn't seem to be the case. Has that changed at all? Have you ever been invited to appear on Nightline or Brinkley? And could you comment on that? Second question. Could you comment generally on the situation in Lebanon? And the second part of that is, I read where Amin Gemayel, the former president of Lebanon, has been given a fellowship at Harvard University. Is Harvard susceptible to a pressure campaign to have him removed as a butcher and a thief? Thank you.
Well, the situation, let me start with the second one, because I don't want to claim anything. I want to continue on false pretenses. I don't claim to understand the situation in Lebanon. Let me start by telling you that. So I'll tell you what I think, but take it with a very big grain of salt, because I don't understand it. I mean, it's very complex, I think. My impression is the following. I mean, the situation in Lebanon, you know, it changes every week, so you got to pick a time frame. Let's pick, say, the last 2 or 3 weeks, because, you know, the alliances can shift, and the people who are now fighting on the same side will be shooting each other and so on. Right at the moment, it looks like there's a split which has, on the one side, basically the organized parts of the Shiite population, the Druze and the Syrians, on the other side, most of the Christian population, and the Sunni Muslims look as if they're sort of split. Now, that's the way it looks, since there's not much opportunity to articulate under those conditions. You can only talk about the way things look. Why did General Aoun decide to raise this confrontation with the Syrians, which looks suicidal? Well, there are a lot of possibilities. I mean, one possibility is just committed nationalist or something like that. Another possibility, which is what I hear from journalists in the Middle East who are close to the topic, is that he's being supported by Iraqi money, and that it's an Iraqi initiative, which would make sense, because the Iraqi-Syrian conflict is a deep one. And Iraq is really a murderous terror state. I mean, it's hard to get one like it. Just little pieces of that story are coming out. It happens to be a U.S. ally at the moment, so nobody talks about it much. But when the truth comes out, if it ever does, it's going to be even uglier than what people think. So that's the way it looks to me. And I don't know what actions can be done to mitigate that situation, to tell you the truth. I don't really have a concrete suggestion to make. Maybe there are other, I'm sure there are other people here who can talk about it much more knowledgeably than I can. As far as access to the media is concerned, you know, if I don't like to personalize it much. I mean, and it's not really the point. The fact of the matter is, if I cross the borders, there's easy access to the media. So it's easy to get on Canadian television and, you know, British television, just to mention two countries that I've been at recently and so on. As for, say, what you mentioned, say, here it's much harder. It's a little easier than it was, say, 20 years ago. And the reason it's a little easier is because there's much more dissidence in the general population. As the contrary to what everybody says, the movements of the 60s broadened and expanded and deepened in the 70s and even more so in the 80s. And the institutions, they're kind of like governments that understand violence. They respond to the need to keep the population passive and quiet and not too disruptive. And if people are getting more engaged and involved and so on, you got to adjust. And one of the consequences is there's a bit more media access for dissidents than there was, say, at the peak of the peace movement when it was virtually zero, contrary to what everybody says. There's a little more. You mentioned Nightline. I mean, yes, I have a couple times been invited to speak on Nightline. Couldn't do it. I had another talk and something or other. And to tell you the honest truth, I don't really care very much. Let me tell you a personal experience. FAIR, the Media Monitoring Group, just published a very interesting study of the people on Nightline. And if you haven't seen it, you ought to. I mean, it shows that this is anything but, I mean, even within what they call the spectrum of opinion, it's very narrow. And their conception of a spectrum is ridiculously narrow, at least by European or world standards. Shortly after that, in fact, shortly after their thing appeared, with a lot of media play, I did actually get an invitation to appear on Nightline. Maybe related, not, maybe not. A couple of weeks after that, I happened to be in Wisconsin, Madison, on a radio, and a listener-supported radio station, community radio station, a very good one, where the news director, I was having an interview with the news director. I've been on that program dozens of times, usually by telephone. He's very good. He gets to all sorts of people. And he started the interview by playing for me a tape of an interview that he had just had and had broadcast with the guy who's some mucky-muck in Nightline. I think his name is Jeff Greenfield or some such name. Does that name mean anything? Somebody, maybe some name like that. That was the person who he was interviewing. And he started off the interview. He played it. It had already been played over the radio, so he just replayed it to me. He started off by saying, well, you know, I'm interested in, you know, there's this criticism of Nightline. Is it true that you have narrow choices? Why doesn't Noam Chomsky appear on Nightline? Well, first comes, the guy starts, a couple of minutes of foaming at the mouth about how he's from Neptune and wacko and so on and so forth. But after the hysteria had sort of receded, he made a point which is in fact quite accurate. He said, we might find some, I'm kind of paraphrasing, but something like this. He said, suppose there's somebody in Turkey who knows all about, you know, I don't know, the INF treaty or something, but can only talk Turkish. Well, that's no good to us. We have to have somebody who can talk English. Furthermore, he said, we have to have somebody who meets the condition of concision. That was the word he used. We have to have concision, meaning you've got to say your thing in a couple of sentences, right? You got to say it fast and short and brief and to the point. And there he hit the thing on the nose. There's a very significant structural fact about the American media, which is much more important, in my view, than the fact that they're so narrow in the range of opinion they permit. And that is that the American media, as far as I know, are alone in the world. I don't know any other country like this, maybe Japan, but nothing in Europe or Canada or Latin America or any of the places I know anything about. The U.S. media are alone in that it is, you must meet the condition of concision. You got to say things between two commercials or in 600 words, you know. Now, see, when you go to, say, Canada or England or Belgium or Spain or any other place, it's not just that you have access to the media. It's that you have a reasonable amount of access to the media, so like maybe 20 minutes, you know, or 45 minutes or something like that. And that's a very important fact because the beauty of concision, you know, saying a couple of sentences between two commercials, the beauty of that is that you can only repeat conventional thoughts. It's a very significant fact. Suppose I get up on Nightline, say, I'm given whatever it is, 2 minutes, and I say, Gaddafi's a terrorist, Khomeini's a murderer, you know, et cetera, et cetera. The Russians, you know, invaded Afghanistan, all this sort of stuff. I don't need any evidence. Everybody just nods. Yeah, obviously, they've heard that 10 million times. I said it, I can go on. What should we do about it? Gaddafi's a terrorist, what should we do about it? Okay, and then I can talk about what we should do about it. Standard media clip on terrorism. You don't need any evidence for what you say. If I say the United States is supporting democracy in El Salvador, but it's had a kind of a setback, what should we do about it? You don't need any evidence, right? On the other hand, suppose you say something that just isn't regurgitating conventional pieties. Suppose you say something that's the least bit unexpected or controversial. Suppose you say, yeah, Gaddafi's a minor league terrorist and George Shultz is a major league terrorist. Now, what should we do about terrorism? You know, suppose you say, the United States didn't get a setback in its effort to support democracy. It got its setback in an effort to pretty up the image so that you can keep funding the state terrorists. Suppose you say that. Well, you know, people will quite reasonably expect to know what you mean. Why did you say that? I never heard that before. If you said that, you better have a reason, you know, better have some evidence. In fact, you better have a lot of evidence because that's a pretty startling comment. You can't give evidence if you're stuck with concision. You know? That's the genius of this structural constraint. So Greenfield or whatever his name is hit the nail on the head. They have designed a system which guarantees only conventional thoughts. Now, if anybody says an unconventional thought, they do sound like they're from Neptune and wacko, like you said, because they're saying something that isn't obvious. and isn't repeated day after day, and therefore reasonable people will ask for arguments and evidence, and they should. You know, you shouldn't accept something you hear. In fact, you shouldn't accept what you hear every day either, but you certainly shouldn't accept what you hear that you never heard before. And if I tell you the world's flat, you want to know why I said it, or else I do sound like I'm from Neptune. Well, the structure of the U.S. media is designed to ensure that you can't say it. And in my view, if people like, say, Nightline and Neil Lehrer and so on were smarter, if they were better propagandists, they would let dissidents on. Let them on more, in fact. And they would let them write op-eds and so on. The reason is that they would sound like they're from Neptune. You know, if they would be saying things which are unconventional and for which they can't give any reasons. Because the system is designed that way. When you're on across the border, it's quite different. Then if you say one of those things, you're allowed to explain what you meant and why you said it and where people can look for more evidence and so on. Furthermore, it's not a one-shot affair. You know, it's happening constantly. That's what freedom means. That's what democracy would mean. And we've got a structural system which denies that. I think it's an important fact.
I just would like to propose another process that I've noticed, particularly in following the Intifada in the media, and have you comment on it. And that is once the media formulates its orientation in some of the processes you've described, they instill a sort of Manichaean dualism, good guys, bad guys categories, where in this particular case, the Palestinians are the bad guys, the Israelis are the good guys, and those actors become locked in these categories. And so that's why when you have, even in the worst days in the Intifada, and you know, despite what the media says, there are still bad days, not a week goes by without some sort of article about the moral crisis that the soldiers are going through by beating these people, so that the good guys don't become bad guys, they go into a moral crisis, and the bad guys just become less of bad guys, that's all.
You're quite right. No comment, except just to say that that's an obvious property of a propaganda system. You know, an obvious property of it. And you're right, absolutely. Notice that the lines can shift a little bit. So as American policy shifts, the choice of good guys and bad guys shifts. The current story is that Israel isn't all the good guys anymore. There's the Labor Party, which are the good guys, healthy pragmatists. And then there's Yitzhak Shamir, who's maybe becoming a bad guy because he doesn't seem to be following orders completely. What makes you a good guy is you're following orders.
My question relates to your statement about states understand the efficacy of violence. If those of us who understand the propaganda model and want to change the assumptions of the state and change the policy of the state, should we advocate or bring about something that's more violent to get them to change their stance? I'm not saying this as an advocacy position, but I am interested in your comment.
No, that doesn't follow. I mean, you know, I'm not myself a committed pacifist. Like, I think it's legitimate to use violence to defend yourself. If I saw somebody breaking into my house and he was trying to kill my kids or something, I would have no hesitation in using violence to stop him. At this point, I break from my pacifist friend. Violence is really a last resort. Now, when I say that states understand the efficacy of violence, I don't mean to approve that fact. Here it's a much broader point. I mean, I think it's worth recognizing that we should recognize the distinction that Harold Laswell made. There's a difference between states that control their population by violence and those that marginalize and control and divert them in other ways. There is a very striking difference. You couldn't do this, what we're doing now, in a state that rules by violence. The United States happens to be deeply committed to violence internationally and even at home, but it's also, comparatively speaking, probably the freest country in the world. At least I don't know another one like it. That is, the limits on the power of the state to coerce by violence are narrower in the United States than any other country I know. That's not to say it's zero. It isn't. But comparatively speaking. And those are important facts. I think that, in fact, is related to the fact that we probably have the most sophisticated propaganda of any country in the world. Exactly as Laswell said, these things have to go along. You can't
if you can't control what people do, you better well control what they think, or else prevent them from thinking or something. Now, what's the way to react? Well, I think the way to react is, first of all, to make use of the options that exist in the system, and they're there. You know, there are political options, there's options in the media, and so on. There are plenty of people inside the media, for example, who understand exactly what's going on. Very well, try to work within it, do what they can. With outside support, they can do more. Outside support means pressure. You know, anything from letters to the editor to going to the editorial office and so on. People in power not only understand the efficacy of violence, they also don't like disruption of their nice, normal ways. What they want is a passive, apathetic population. And if they don't have that, that's a cost. And that's a cost to which you have to adjust. Since you can't instill that by force in the United States, I mean, you can, say, in the ghettos and so on, but for relatively privileged people, you can't do it by force. You have to do it by adjusting. That's the way in which informal politics can create a margin of survival for people who were at the wrong ends of the gun. I mean, say, suppose you're doing Central America solidarity work or something. What you're doing is creating enough pressure and disruption so that the state will have to adjust in order to prevent threats to major interests of power. And they will adjust. That's why the Reagan administration went underground right away, for example, in fear of the domestic enemy, the domestic population. Now, on this issue, and you got to choose, you know, you have to choose what you do based on the issue that you're confronting. This issue, I think, is a different one, to tell you the truth. I think it's a very different one. If you want to talk about how to affect U.S. policy on this issue, I think we should recognize that it's quite different from the Central American issue. In the Central American issue, there's an elite consensus across the board that reform movements cannot be permitted to survive. The Sandinistas cannot be permitted to survive precisely because they were directing resources to the poor. And that's unacceptable. On that, there's unanimity. You know, if you don't agree with that, you're from Neptune. And there you have to respond in a certain way. You have to respond by organizing people, by creating disruption, by making costs, and so on and so forth. This issue is quite different. On this issue, first of all, there's an elite split. There are substantial elements of real power in the United States who have always been in favor of political settlement. It's an unusual case in this respect. That split that I mentioned between Rogers and Kissinger is only symbolic. There's a real split in elite, you know, centers. For example, the oil companies typically have been in favor of political settlement. Now, they're pretty powerful. And with regard to Middle East policy, they're usually very powerful, in fact, dominant. They've lost on this one. People like, say, George Ball are reflecting real interests, and they've lost. There are other real interests that prefer to have the conflict maintained and, you know, commit themselves to strategic asset theory and like to have a mercenary state that they can use to, you know, do things the United States can't do in Guatemala and be a base for U.S. power in the region and interchange intelligence and try out technology and all that kind of stuff. And by and large, they've won. But that's a split. Furthermore, if you look at the U.S. population, most of the population doesn't care. But to the extent that they care, they're about 2-1 in favor of a Palestinian state and have always been. But it's not a deep commitment, so, you know, it's sort of irrelevant politically. So here you have a situation where there's an elite split. If we're talking about a diplomatic settlement, then that means some kind of, you know, two-state settlement, probably some kind of confederation or something. Something on that order. If we're talking about a non-rejectionist settlement, a settlement which recognizes the right of national self-determination of both people and safeguards it and so on, you got most of the population on your side to begin with. You have powerful elements of American corporate power, for example, which typically run the government, on your side to begin with. And it's a different sort of issue. In fact, what has held this issue, I think this is one of the very unusual cases, almost rare, maybe unique cases, in which near unanimity among in educated circles, particularly liberal educated circles, has swung the balance. There's been virtually no discussion or debate over this issue. In fact, until very recently, you couldn't even talk about it because you'd get, you know, assassinated. I mean, not with a gun, but verbal assassination. And that's tough. It means that politicians don't want to speak up because they can't live with that. And journalists don't want to write because you can't take all that stuff. And other people just don't want to get involved. You know, you don't want to be the target of vast amounts of vilification and lies and denunciations and so on and so forth. It's just unpleasant. You know? Not a nice way to live. And if you're in public life, you can't live that way. There's no way to answer it. Notice that if people throw slime at you, there's no way to respond. You can't say, it's not there. You know, nobody's going to follow the details of an argument. I mean, anybody who slings mud understands that. You always win, can't lose, especially when you've got control of the media. And in this case, the media have reflected articulate intellectual opinion, including the liberal media. There's basically been no discussion. That's why it's been possible to suppress the history so completely. Let me give you some examples of what's happened. Actually, a very interesting study done at Georgetown a couple of years ago by Montague Kern. There's a study done at Georgetown by a person, I don't know if it's a man or a woman, named Montague Kern. Woman? Yeah. A very extremely interesting study. It was done, must have been done around 79 or approximately then. It's a study of... it's one of the most interesting media studies I know. It's a study of what happened in 1977. It was very interesting what happened. In October 1977, when Carter came into office, it looked as if he was going to move towards the international consensus and call for a political settlement. It looked like that. And in October 1977, there was a joint statement, a Soviet-American statement, which called for a reduction of tension and, an end to conflict and move towards political settlement. It didn't spell anything out very much, but it was obviously a move towards politics and away from the arena of violence. Well, the reaction to that was kind of interesting. First of all, Israel was vehemently opposed to it. The whole Israeli lobby here, which is not Jews, much broader, the Israeli lobby was vehemently opposed to it. And they got organized, and they largely dominate the media. And then comes Montague Kern's study. She studied the way the media treated this issue. Now, typically, on just about every issue, when the President of the United States is in conflict with somebody else outside, say another country, the way the media work is, you turn on the television tube and there's the President or, spokesman for the President giving the official line. And you go on and on with that, and you get commentators endorsing it. And then in the interest of fairness, sort of at the end of the program, right after the last ad, you get the other guys who can say three words, That's the usual way it's done. In this case, it was the opposite. The primary focus was on the Israeli spokesman and the Americans who supported them. And then towards the end, Jimmy Carter was allowed in to make a kind of a plea that, maybe he's not totally from Neptune again. And that's basically what she documents. Now that's unusual. In fact, it's unique. I don't even know of another case like it. And what that reflects is something that happened in the educated part of the community. And it happened for reasons having to do with the United States, I think. Big story. But it happened in 1967. There was tremendous enthusiasm in educated circles in the United States for the Israeli victory. I think it had probably more to do with Vietnam War and the peace movement and the students and so on than it had to do with the Middle East. Israel had shown how to put third world upstarts in their place, and that won them a lot of points. You have to remember what was happening in the United States at that time. And I suspect that that's the source of a lot of it, but if that's true, it means you're dealing with quite a different issue. Here you're dealing with the matter of trying to gain, to act within the public political system and the public media system without even breaking its rules. You've even got power lined up on your side. It's going to require a willingness to accept and to overcome the barriers, the barriers that are imposed by the cultural managers themselves. But they're not very powerful. They're powerful only when they're not challenged. And I think they can be challenged on this. If that's correct, that suggests quite different tactics. It suggests information, pressures, writing, speaking, organizing people in communities, things like that. And I think it could happen on this issue and could lead to a shift in policy. Different issues require different tactics, and you got to really think it through.
American University, where you're going to speak tomorrow, is the home of WAMU, which is one of the national public radio stations in town. And to my mind, both nationally and locally, their news is a very good example of the liberal defining point of how far left you can go. A group of us are going to go Thursday and talk with the program manager, and sometimes I get inspired when I read Extra, Fair's publication, and then sometimes I think it's easy to get discouraged and think that they're impenetrable, especially when I see so many people who seem like they're on the verge of being disillusioned by the propaganda, who think that it's wonderful just because it's so much nicer than the vicious other extreme. There's two things I wanted to ask you. One is, if you could say anything more about, like, where is that margin? Where is the weak point that can have some sort of effect? And the other thing is, national public radio is a little bit different from those corporations that sell us to the advertisers, and yet why does it sound so much the same?
Well, national public radio is not all that different. First of all, it is a little different, but it's not all that different. For one thing, remember, it is corporate subsidized. And the other thing is, it's run by the government, and the government is corporate run. You know, so it's just a step more remote. Now, nevertheless, it's susceptible to pressures. And I don't think one should be discouraged. In fact, it doesn't take much in the way. It's amazing how little it often takes in the way of pressure. I mean, you can often get a person in Congress to change a vote if they get six letters. Literally. You know. I mean, not on a major issue of their deep concern, but on issues of great importance. And the same is true of National Public Radio and CBS and everything else. They don't like disruption. And if there's any indication, and they don't like popular involvement. I mean, remember, the people have to be apathetic. That's the ideal. And if people are getting involved in things, you want to put them down. And one way you put them down is by doing a little of what they want and hoping they'll go away. Now, that's to the good. If they do a little of what you want and then you don't go away, well, okay, there'll be more. No. So if you're looking forward to a revolution in the media, forget it. That's going to require a revolution in the society. But changes are certainly possible. There's plenty of adjustment possible. And I don't think there's anything general to say. I think it depends on the issue. For example, I think it would be extremely difficult, in fact, near impossible without a social revolution, to get the media to admit or even to face the possibility that the United States has traditionally, for quite good reasons, opposed democracy and social reform and is still doing it, or to get them to admit that Nicaragua had an election which, by any rational standards, is far better than the one in El Salvador. To get that to be admitted is probably impossible. But you can get changes, nevertheless. You know, there's a big margin between what they're willing to do and what they could do without harming their basic interests and commitments. And those things should be pressed. Also, there are plenty of people in the media who would like that kind of support. You know, who could do more if they had more outside support? It's not a monolith. But one of the effects of the 60s, remember, is that a lot of people who came out, that was a big experience for lots of people. I think it extended in the 70s and even more in the 80s. But the effect is that a lot of people have come through those experiences and they see things differently. And they're older and they're inside the society now. And they would like to see things change. Not revolutionary changes. They just like to see modifications. And that gives lots of options that weren't there before. So these trips of yours down to the offices, I expect will have an effect. Not in one shot. You know, you got to keep at it. You got to be dedicated. And then it can have an effect. One or two more questions, I suppose.
Yeah. Okay. I'd just like to pick up on your last comment on social revolution. And I'd like to know what you mean, one, by a social revolution.
one or two more questions, I suppose.
Okay. I'd just like to pick up on your last comment on social revolution. And I'd like to know what you mean, one, by a social revolution and what it would take. And I have another question, actually my original question, which is, what do you think of Neil Postman's book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, in which he argues that the media and the mass, especially television, has reduced Americans' ability to think rationally because of the way that the information is given to them. In other words, he's arguing that before the media really became very rapid with commercials and everything, people read more and were more able to tie their thoughts together.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, let's start with the second one again. I think there's a lot to what Neil Postman says. Remember, I started off by saying I was going to talk about the elite media, the agenda-setting media. I mean, roughly speaking, you know, this is an oversimplification, but as a first approximation, we want to distinguish two categories of citizens. We want to distinguish what's sometimes called the political class from the rest. The political class is the upper middle class, educated, articulate, politically active, went to the good colleges. They're going to be able to participate in management, whether it's corporate management or state management or ideological management. And I include in that things like teaching and so on. That's one sector, small sector of the population. Then there's the rest of those slobs out there who are just supposed to be turning screws and that sort of thing. Now, that's as a start, that's not the whole story. It's more differentiated than that, but that's a start. Now, they're treated differently in the media. The first group, they're treated differently in the schools. It's been studied, in fact. For the slobs, you know, the 80% or whatever they are, the main thing for them is to divert them, to get them to watch National Football League. And to worry about, you know, mother with child with six heads or whatever you pick up in the, you know, in the thing that you pick up on the supermarket stands and so on. Or to, you know, look at astrology or get involved in, you know, fundamentalist stuff or something. Or just get them away, you know. Get them away from things that matter. And for that, it's important to reduce their capacity to think. Because they're just supposed to follow orders, basically. Now, you have to remember, it's not very far back that there was a live working class culture in the United States. I mean, I'm just old enough, they're just about old enough to remember. The most educated people I ever met in my life were Jewish working class people in New York in the 1930s. Most of them never went to school, you know. But they read, they went to concerts, they had arguments, they had debates. That's where I learned most of everything I know. Some of them never got past fourth grade, you know, meaning less indoctrination. But it was a live, ongoing, you know, working class culture. It took a long time to destroy it. In other countries, it still hasn't been destroyed. The United States is more advanced. So let's say in England, like when I go to, last time I was in England a couple months ago, I gave a talk. Here, when I give a talk on these topics, either in a university or a church or something like that, in England, one was in a town hall, the other was in a guild hall. Well, that's, you know, a union hall, you know. Out of the question. The concept doesn't exist. The reason is that England still has the residue of a working class movement. Until the 1960s, it had a very lively working class press, daily press, which more people read than read the elite press, and was good, serious newspapers, presented a different conception of the world day after day after day. Different values, you know, different conception of the right that people have to their product of their own labor, to their right to participate in what happens in the world, international affairs, everything. Just a different value system, different morality, different interpretation. Well, that succumbed to market forces, you know, basically to market forces, and I talked about before. In the United States, it happened a long time ago. In other European countries, they're kind of more backward. It'll take them a while longer to reach the U.S. system of sort of depoliticization, one political party, no structured media to prevent dissent. That's more sophisticated. But what you're saying, what Postman is saying and what you're saying, I think is very right. I mean, a large part of the media are in fact directed to that. But don't forget that the managers have to understand things. Now, the people who are running the corporations have to know how to make more or less rational decisions. And the people who are running the state have to know how to serve the interests of the people with private power. You need the people who are experts in Kissinger's sense, who know how to articulate the consensus of the powerful and serve their interests. And the people who are writing the editorials have to sort of understand things, and the journalists have to do it, and so on and so forth. Now, they have to do it within a particular framework. You don't want them to think too much. You know, you want them to think within fixed bounds, but they've got to be able to think. And there's real contradictions there, incidentally. You see the contradictions in the universities very strikingly. So, for example, in the natural sciences, it's extremely hard to be dishonest and uncreative. I mean, you've got nature out there keeping you honest, you know. You can do a false experiment, but somebody's going to catch you up in no time because nature is out there. You write a false book about the French Revolution, you can do it forever, you know. Nobody's going to stop you until ideological changes take place. You can tell these fabrications about modern contemporary history, and as long as power is on your side, it doesn't matter. Because as long as power is on your side, it's the illusions that are real and the reality that's irrelevant. It's actually true as long as power is on your side. You don't have nature out there keeping you honest. And you see a difference. I mean, you just see a difference in the intellectual culture, you know. But the point is, in the kind of ideological side of the culture, you know, the humanities and social sciences and so on, you still have to be able to think. At the same time, you have to be able to not think, because if you think too much, you come up with the wrong idea. So there's a delicate line that has to be drawn, and it's a tricky one to keep, you know. Universities and the schools and so on have their problems with it. And the universities do too. The newspapers do too. The point is, there are conflicting values. You know, there's the value that says you better tell the truth, for one thing because you've got some professional integrity, and for another thing because people in power have to understand the real world. On the other hand, there's the pressure that says you better not tell the truth, because then you're going to see things wrongly, you're going to undermine illusions, and so on and so forth. And those are real conflicts, and you can play on them, you know. Within limits, you can play on them. So I think he's right, but only about part of the media. And I happen to be talking about the other part, primarily. So what we're saying is kind of complementary. As for a social revolution, that's not, you can't give a pat answer to that. But, you know, it's a hard problem, and that's not just another talk, but a lot of talk. The question is, what do we think is a just society? Now, the United States is founded on a principle, the one that is expressed by the founding fathers: the people who own the country ought to govern it. They said it straight out, because those were nice, open, honest days. We don't say it, we just have it built into everything. Those who own the country ought to govern it. And that's sort of what happens. You, wherever you come from, ask who your congressional representative is. Take the House of Representatives, which is the most representative part of the government, and ask yourself who your representative is. And the chances are you're going to, and ask what that representative is going to do if he, or less likely she, is voted out of office, which is a very rare event since we basically have a one-party system with no replacement. But suppose it happens, what are they going to do? Is that person going to become a truck driver or a grocery store clerk or a, you know, a farm laborer or, you know, assembly line worker or something like that? Chances are no. Chances are that person's going to go back to work in a corporate law office or, some managerial position or somewhere else in the state system or something like that. Maybe a professor at a university or something. But one of the tiny, narrow, elite professions. And that means that's who they're representing. Now, that was a live issue in the 18th century. Very live issue. That was a live issue in the years after the American Revolution. You take a look back at the struggles at the time of the Articles of the Confederation and federalism and so on, and those were some of the issues that were being fought about. The question was, are people going to be represented by people like themselves, or are they going to be represented by the gentry, the aristocrats, the rich, and so on? Well, the Federalists won. Even despite their electoral defeat, they basically won. People were represented by the rich. Same thing happened in the English Revolution of the 17th century. In fact, it happens in every revolution. You know, you take a look at any revolution you want, you'll find conflicts among elites, And then you've got this mass of a population that wants to get rid of all of them, you know, and they usually lose. And one or the other of the elite groups takes power. They can call themselves Bolsheviks or some other thing. But one or another of the elites takes power, and the general population, the kind of radical Democrats, usually lose. They may not lose everything. Like, they make some gains, but they don't gain the right to be represented by people like themselves, to have direct participation, to eliminate the very notion of coercion and power. They don't, so far in history, they haven't gained that. And that's what a social revolution would be, I think. It would be realizing the actual ideals of the Enlightenment and of the early revolutionary period, meaning that the very idea of people being forced to rent themselves in order to survive is obscene. You know, not as bad as being forced to sell yourself to survive, but it's not all that different. That was understood a century or two ago. It can be understood again. The idea that that the role of a person in a political system is to ratify decisions made by others, that's unacceptable in a real democracy. The idea that you have to select among the narrow class of people who own the country or their representatives and that's what political participation means, I would think that should be unacceptable in a political system. And changing all of those things would be a social revolution. It would mean taking control over the fundamental decisions of the society, whether they're decisions over production or distribution or consumption or governance or whatever, and making them authentically popular in popular groupings, whether they're in the workplace or the community or other arrangements and so on. Now, you know, exactly how that should look like, well, you know, there it becomes not so simple. But it seems to me those are the directions in which a radical democratic revolution would move, and it's not something particularly novel. This means reconstructing ideals which always show up in popular struggles, and I've been doing it for centuries. One more?
I'm sorry, I just wanted to ask, this is, first of all, if I say, I want to explain that this is the first time I ever heard you speaking, so some of my thinking might be a little bit naive or facile. But a lot of the basic examples and discussions that you've talked about tonight are sort of a big version, big, mature, sophisticated, and quite important version of saying that, you know, Santa Claus doesn't exist, and, you know, faith is no good, and intellect is, and rationale is good. And what I was wondering was, of course, you see intellect and rationale as beyond faith, as something out there. Reality is outside of what we're living in, and it just seems to me, I just wonder what your agenda is, because although you deny, you think that basically the right to exercise power by states outside of their national boundaries, it seems to me, is legitimate, and yet you're saying that the method of sort of pacifying the domestic population is not. But what I'm wondering then is your agenda then merely to sort of expand the number of people inside the government, or inside the country rather, who can participate in that decision-making process of exercising power? In other words, are you, by speaking about these sorts of things, talking about if we have a government here that is ruled by people who own something in the country, are you claiming then that you have a right to claim a piece of intellectual property, which gives people in this room as well who gain intellectual property a right to have to exercise influence within that government as it projects its power overseas?
I'm not sure I understood that, to say the truth. I didn't think it was possible and feasible if people do something about it. Now, as far as the agenda is concerned, well, you know, it starts narrow and it goes up. The narrowest point, I mean, I wouldn't bother doing this unless I thought, unless I meant what I said. What I said is, I urge you to look at the facts and see if this sketch is right or if something else is right. So that's what I'd like to do. I'd like to convince people to try to figure out what's going on. That's the lowest thing. Just urge people to figure out what's going on. I tell you what I think's going on, you know. I don't own any intellectual property, incidentally. Anybody else can say what they think is going on in the kind of society I'd like to see. Like, for example, the reason I repeat that I urge you to check the documents is I'm not even trying to persuade you. Just like when I teach a graduate course, I'm not trying to persuade the students. I mean, that's maybe what you do in a theology course or something. But if you're teaching a graduate course in the sciences, you're not trying to persuade your students, at least if you're any good or you know what you're up to. You're trying to get them to be able to figure out what's going on. And you know perfectly well you're probably wrong, because you've always been wrong in the past, and so has every other scientist been wrong in the past. So you're trying to get them to figure out what's going on and correct your errors and do it better and so on. Same here. I mean, I'm not trying to persuade you that this is right, but I want to get you to think of it, to convince you that it's worth thinking about, figure out what's right. If you do, I think you're going to find something like what I said, but maybe not. So that's the lowest concern. Second concern is that after you figure out what's right, you're going to want to do something about it. And there are a lot of things that can be done. We've just been talking about that. I think there are a lot of people suffering in the world, here and elsewhere. We've been talking about a few of those problems, plenty of others. Many of the people who are suffering because of us. Now, there's a lot of things we can't do much about. Like somebody raised the question of Lebanon, frankly. I said I have no suggestion on what we can do about it. Maybe somebody else does, but I don't. There are things happening in many places I don't think we can do much about. Some things we can do a lot about because we're primarily responsible. So, for example, the failure of a diplomatic settlement in the Middle East, we are primarily responsible for that, I think. That's what I think you're going to discover if you check the record. If that's the case, and a lot of people are suffering from that, in fact, the world may blow up because of it. Very threatening situation, quite apart from the local victims. If that's, in fact, the case, there's a lot that we can do about it. And I'd like to see people do it. Same with regard to Central America, which I mentioned. You know, where there's hundreds of thousands of people have been slaughtered down there in this last decade. That's because of you and me, not Mars. You know, we let it happen. And we don't have to. We can do something about it. There are other things where it's less easy to do it. As for your general principle, I don't agree that states have a right to exert force across their borders. I really don't agree with that. And furthermore, see, if the word conservative, which in my view is an honorable word, if it hadn't lost its meaning entirely and been turned into its opposite, like peace process, we would recognize that to be a very conservative position. In fact, that's part of the supreme law of the land in the United States. If you're a law-abiding person, you just think we have a reasonably good system of laws, you agree that it's a war crime, kind of thing for which people were hanged at Nuremberg, for a state to exercise force beyond its boundaries. Therefore, it's kind of surprising that people think that's legitimate. I mean, was Hitler legitimate? That's what the Nazis were tried for exerting force beyond their boundaries. It was a post hoc decision, so you could claim it's fraudulent. And in fact, there's a lot of fakery about it. But the principles which are enshrined in the UN Charter, which is a valid treaty and therefore the supreme law of the land, are very clear about this. Now, they leave some margin of debate, like anything does, but they're quite clear. They specify the cases where states, they begin by accepting the international system. Well, I think that's a transitory system that ought to be improved. But let's begin by accepting it. Then it says, in that system, states are not permitted to use force, or even the threat of force. They're not even permitted to use the threat of force. And the only exception to that, there's only two exceptions to that. One is if authorized by the UN Security Council, they felt like you can send peacekeeping troops to Namibia. And the other is in the case of armed attack. When you're directly attacked, like somebody crosses your border and begins attacking you, then you can use force up till the point where the Security Council acts. That's it. Anything else is illegal, the kind of crime for which we hanged people at Nuremberg with lots of noble rhetoric about how the principles apply to us, too. It's a conservative position to say we ought to obey our own laws. And to say blandly states have a right to exert force in international affairs is to say the Nuremberg trials were wrong. You know, wrong in principle. Perfectly okay for Hitler and the Japanese to do what they did. It was a mistake to condemn them. I don't agree with that. You know, there's a lot wrong with the international system and international law, but those things are right. And I think we ought to try to live up to them. we could play a constructive role in world affairs in theory. And if we could stop, we could get our boots off people's necks, then we could start talking about how to do that. But to exert force or to carry out embargoes and that kind of stuff, that's just flat wrong. In fact, there's a world court decision which the United States rejects because we're a lawless state, demanding that we stop the unlawful use of force. Kind of interesting that nobody cares about that because we take for granted that we're a lawless state. But I don't think we should.